The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating over 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. This podcast is brought to you through the generous financial support of the Tongyang Group. In the areas of financial services and manufacturing, the companies of the Tongyang Group harness the passion and creativity of 12,000 employees worldwide to better serve their clients. The Tongyang Group, a global partner for Korean business. On July 21, 2009, Joseph V. DeMarco, a partner at DeVore & DeMarco LLP, who specializes in counseling clients on information privacy and security, sat down with the Korea Society's Daniel Levine to share his perspective on evolving trends in cybercrime in the context of recent attacks targeting U.S. and South Korean government and commercial websites. He explained how developments on both sides of the law have forever affected the way businesses, individuals, and criminals interact in the global economy, and how the U.S. and the Republic of Korea can learn from one another in addressing the challenges presented by the darker side of the digital revolution.
So I spoke to the society maybe 2.5 months ago with respect to cybercrime and the global economy and challenges that cybercrime poses to the United States and South Korea, what those similarities are, what some of those differences are, what prompts my return here to speak to the society again today are the recent events from earlier this month, and those principally relate to the large-scale denial-of-service attacks, which were launched by perpetrators at yet still conclusively not identified against various leading websites in the United States and in South Korea. As it happens, I spent a good bit of my remarks 3 months ago discussing denial of service attacks, and I certainly had no inside knowledge and certainly no involvement with the attacks, but it turned out that a lot of what I said came to pass. And what I thought was interesting to members of the society, especially those that are technologically savvy, follow technological developments both in the United States and in South Korea, and who also may follow cybercrime events as they happen around the world, would be really just to spend a few minutes talking and thinking about how this global phenomenon that we call cybercrime affects computer users in the United States and in South Korea. They're obviously, you know, among the two most technologically advanced cultures and societies on the planet. And I think that when you look at the ways in which cybercrime affects people in the U.S. and South Korea, there are some real shared lessons to be learned, some common vulnerabilities, and perhaps some common strategies for enforcement. So against that backdrop, I thought really it was the place to start really was just kind of understand what we're talking about when we talk about cybercrime, just so that we all have the same definition of what it is. And as many of you, your members know, for many years, I was a federal prosecutor here in New York City, where I was the head of the Computer Hacking and Intellectual Property Unit. And so in a nutshell, I was responsible for investigating and prosecuting all of the cybercrime and computer malfeasance that took place in and around New York City. And what that encompassed and what the subject of cybercrime still really encompasses are a number of things. Most prominently, of course, there's computer hacking, you know, breaking into someone else's computer, in order to steal information, to implant spyware on that person's computer, or to maybe just host illegally copyrighted software on that person's computer, so that if the people who own that software are onto you, instead of finding out where you are, they go to some innocent victim where you've stored your cache of illegally copied movies, music, games, whatever it may be. That's a very common form of cybercrime. Another common form of cybercrime involves targeted attacks designed to take over and in some cases destroy entire computer networks. And these principally relate to what are known as denial of service attacks. And many of your members are familiar with these because of the events earlier this month. Now, a denial of service attack, or what's known as a distributed denial of service attack, or DDoS attack, is, I'm sure you know from your prior affiliation with Computer PC Magazine, essentially involves bombarding victim computers with meaningless streams of data. If you think of a computer as either a circuit or as a brain, it's possible to just simply overload that computer with data and information and cause it to crash. Most computers, especially computers that are connected to the internet, are constantly transmitting data to and from one another, but within specified parameters. Once you go beyond those specified parameters, you can cause those computers to crash. And the most common example would be, for example, if everyone on the planet logged on to the website of the Korea Society, most likely the Korea Society website would come down. It would simply be overloaded with information. Now, in a denial of service attack or a distributed denial of service attack, someone, for whatever reason, some bad guy out there, wants to disable a computer system by flooding it with meaningless requests for information or meaningless requests for access. But since most of the large commercial sites can handle a great deal of queries and a great deal of information, in order to pull this off, someone who wants to launch a successful denial of service attack needs literally tens of thousands of their computers to be at their disposal. Now, how do you get tens of thousands of computers to do your bidding? Well, one way is to infect them with computer viruses. Viruses which, in effect, turn those computers into slaves, into your slaves, or your zombies, as they're known. What you then can do is, at a time and place of your choosing, have those zombie computers, tens of thousands of them, direct queries to a list of computers that you want to knock out. And you could choose your list based on personal animosity. You know, you have a gripe against a company. Or depending on who you are, if you have a motive that touches on, you know, politics, you could do that if you are especially connected to a state or a subnational group against your enemies, other states and other groups. Those types of attacks are extraordinarily difficult to prevent against. It can be done, but it's very, very difficult to do. They're also very hard to trace back. It's very difficult to find out who is ultimately behind a denial of service attack, because by definition, the bad guy is not using his or her own computer as a launch point. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about DDoS attacks, and I won't belabor the point too much. We'll come back to it at the end. But in this world that, that we live in called the internet, it's not uncommon for individuals and entities to buy and sell lists of compromised zombie computers. And the people that do this, the bad guys, who do this, are known as bot herders. Bot meaning a short term for robot, robot computers being the zombie computers that the bot herder controls. And an entire subculture of the internet exists where these zombie computers are, access to these zombie computers are sold. A very difficult type of cybercrime to get at, to prosecute, and to prevent against. Of course, there are also, you know, other types of cybercrimes ranging from web page defacements, where people will simply defame groups. When I was a prosecutor at the Department of Justice one year, I think it was in 1999, someone hacked the Department of Justice's webpage and, you know, transformed the logo from Department of Justice to Department of Injustice. And everyone got a kick out of that, although, as you might imagine, the people at the Department of Justice were not exactly chuckling. There are a whole range of frauds that occur online as well. There are stock pump and dump schemes. There are mass marketing phishing schemes and identity theft schemes, and all of these crimes exist online. Together with, of course, all types of intellectual property crimes, all types of piracy crimes, whether it's someone getting a pre-release version of a movie from a Hollywood studio or from a Korean movie studio, stripping off the anti-circumvention features, the code which makes it otherwise impossible to copy the work, and then perhaps putting it up on a password-protected site in the Netherlands, let's say, to which they give their buddies access. Those are common forms of intellectual property crimes that occur online. And as we'll see in a moment, you know, each of these crimes, by virtue of the fact that the United States and Korea are so technology and so internet dependent, have disproportionate impacts on our societies than they do on countries where computers, internet technology, and e-commerce play a less significant role. Of course, there are other types of cybercrimes which are more analogous to crimes in the physical world, and some that are in the news recently with respect to both the United States and Korea involve harassment, cyberstalking, the spreading of false and malicious rumors, especially about celebrated personalities, which occasionally has led to those people committing suicide. And, you know, we have a case in the United States here which has gotten some attention involving Lori Drew, who was involved in a impersonation on a MySpace page and ultimately wound up impersonating a young boy in correspondence with a minor girl, left the correspondence off, suggesting that the world would be better off if the young girl was not alive, and the young girl killed herself. And that woman was prosecuted here in the United States. There's also, of course, the case of Jin Shil Choi in Korea, who had rumors about her spread online, ultimately leading many believe to the cause of her suicide. Of course, the phenomenon of cybercrime is just growing every year by leaps and bounds. I won't belabor the point, but in the United States, the rise in cybercrime complaints to the FBI's Computer and Internet Crime Complaint Center rose by something like 33% between 2007 and 2008. Similarly, or analogously in Korea, Korean police officials report that cybercrime arrests rose 12% from 2006 to 2007 in South Korea. And of course, piracy is just growing at astronomical rates. The estimate is that in the U.S., losses to American companies from software piracy exceed $9 billion a year, and in Korea exceed more than $500 million, over half a billion dollars a year. So that is what we're talking about when we're talking about what is cybercrime. The perpetrators, of course, can be anyone, right? Because computers are ubiquitous. They can be individual juveniles who want to hack a website because they think it's fun. They can be organized crime groups operating out of different parts of the globe, many of whom are comprised of people with very, very good computer skills. Some of them are former government officials from some countries in the Soviet bloc who've turned to crime to basically make a living. There are, of course, state sponsors. States, most nation states with well-developed high technology capacities have units of their military devoted to information warfare, and they include subnational and transnational groups as well. So I said at the beginning that the United States and Korea share some similarities. Well, in a more granular form, what are those similarities? Well, obviously, both countries have very, very high percentages of computer usage. In the United States, per capita computer ownership is at about 74%, which is 14th in the worldwide. In Korea, it's a little bit higher, 76%, 11th worldwide. So we're talking about countries where more or less everybody has a computer. Of course, many, many people have two, you know, some have none, but when you per capita average it out, virtually everyone has a computer. Both countries also are heavily dependent on high-speed computer power and high-speed computer usage. Korea has about 14 million broadband subscribers out of a population of a little over 40 million. The United States has 66 million broadband subscribers out of a population of around 300 million. What that means in practical terms is that computer crime, computer viruses, any type of computer malfeasance that you're talking about can move around faster. Right? I mean, in the olden days, if you were robbing banks, you know, you wanted to get a fast horse as your getaway transit. You know, a slow horse, a broken down mule, probably wasn't going to outrun the bullets that came chasing after you. Then along came the automobile. Much easier to make a fast getaway. Well, when you're talking about cybercrime, one thing that that cybercriminals look for, one thing they want, is good bandwidth, big pipe in the parlance of people that live in this space. And they want that for several reasons. First, because if you're doing something like launching a distributed denial of service attack, it makes it much more effective to launch your attack if you're launching that over a nation's computer system, computer network that can handle it. If you want to send out, you know, 10 billion queries to whitehouse.gov, the U.S. Web server, web domain address for the White House's website, you want to do that over big pipe. You don't want to get choked up at the ISPs. You want your denial of service attack to get through. Similarly, even with respect to something as different from a denial of service attack as internet piracy, if you're involved in the illegal download of large major motion pictures, whether they're Korean or U.S. movies or games that are very rich in data, you need good bandwidth to move that movie at a decent clip, right? Who wants a movie that's going to take 15 days to download an illegal copy of? No one. So both countries have big pipe. And as a result of that, cyber criminals can ride on that network and can choose to ride on those networks and can choose to commit their crimes in Korea and the United States because they have a very fast way of getting around. Naturally, also, both countries have very well-developed e-commerce segments. Both countries have companies and individuals that host huge amounts of data online. Both countries have cultures that are very fond of online entertainment, whether it's games, movies, or whatever the case may be. And so I guess what I'm saying in a nutshell is that both countries, to really a degree unparalleled, in the rest of the world, I mean, you're really talking about two of the countries in the list of, let's say, the top 10 countries, clearly two of the top 10 countries that live online more than anyone else who's not in that top 10 list, and transact business and transact the functions of their daily life in ways that people in other countries, less technologically developed countries, simply don't. And of course, that has wonderful positive effects, but there's a downside to that as well. And the downside is perhaps a slightly greater downside to Korea than the United States, if only because Korea's attachment to the technologies is even greater than in the United States. I mean, in Seoul, of course, you can flip open your cell phone and change the air conditioning temperature in your apartment. And you can record movies, and you can do a whole host of things, especially when it comes to mobile electronics, that the United States is still a few years away from. As a purely practical matter, what that means is that when those systems are attacked and successfully brought down, people in those countries, in the United States and in Korea, are inconvenienced at best, or have their lives seriously disrupted at worst when that occurs. And I think what we saw most recently with the denial of service attacks in the United States and in Korea is how that can play out. Now, of course, there are some differences too. And while this isn't a lecture specifically on law, my training as a lawyer leads me to dial in on those as well. I've mentioned already a couple, the greater Korean reliance on mobile devices and the like. There are some legal differences as well. Korea law requires people who use the internet to register in ways that the United States don't, which makes the tracing of internet crimes more easy. Korea has certain laws that the United States doesn't that make the malicious spreading of misinformation online a crime. And you're familiar with the recent case involving the individual who was spreading false information about the Korean financial markets being arrested and then ultimately unmasked. But those differences, are really not that significant, because when it comes right down to it, if there's a serious illegal activity that occurs online, it's going to be a crime in both places. So let me talk a little bit about the denial of service attacks that recently occurred, and then maybe offer some speculation on what the future holds for the two countries. And I do think that the two countries can learn a great deal from one another. Of course, both have very good technology and academic communities devoted to studying the subjects. Both have very good law enforcement and military expertise in the areas. But my ears really pricked up 3 weeks ago when the news reports in the morning talked about a massive global distributed denial of service attack that was primarily targeting websites and web servers in Korea and the United States. And many people might have scratched their heads and said, well, gee, why is that so? I think some of the reasons that I've spoken about already indicate why. Now, of course, this happened coincidental shortly after the launch of certain missiles by North Korea, as well as certain developments in negotiations, as well as public statements among and between the various countries on the subject of North Korea's use of nuclear technology or missile technology, I guess more accurately. In a nutshell, on the morning of July the 4th, people woke up hearing about the recent attacks against a host of websites. In the United States here, the White House website was bombarded with a denial of service attack. The New York Stock Exchange's website was. The FAA's website was. The Federal Trade Commission's website was. MarketWatch was a financial website here, as well as NASDAQ's website. The NSA's website here was attacked. In Korea, a number of ISPs were attacked. The U.S. Military South Command's website was attacked, according to published reports. Two Korean banks, I believe one of them was Woori Bank, was attacked, but another major bank as well as a major Korean internet service provider. Now, of course, most of these are either governmental or major commercial websites that have pretty good defenses in place against denial of service attacks. Some of them came down, albeit briefly. Some of them had traffic on their networks slowed, but naturally, in light of the events that were corresponding to these attacks, suspicion immediately rose that either individuals or state actors in North Korea were behind it. Now, I have no inside scoop on who really launched it. I'm just reading what's in the public as well as the academic press on the subject. As I understand it from reading that, the number of slave zombie computers that were involved ranged anywhere from 60,000 to 120,000. It was not, according to press reports, a terribly sophisticated attack. But then again, as I said earlier, by definition, distributed denial of service attacks are really not that complicated. It really is just simply an overload to a computer system. Interestingly, there were some reports that the attack also embedded a Trojan or a particular type of virus onto affected computer users' hard drives, which on a certain date, some zero date in the future, would erase all of the data on that hard drive. I haven't seen anything further on that subject, but that seems to have been part of it. Some academics have traced the attack to a master computer in the United Kingdom. But again, as you know, on the internet, it's very easy to fake where you are. It's also easy, of course, for the person behind this or the group behind this to have compromised that computer and used that computer as a launching point. So while I've not seen any definitive links to North Korea, there clearly is a coincidental timing factor involved, and there have been some reports, although I don't believe that they've been attributed to any individuals in particular, coming out of Korean government security services that have suggested that North Korea was behind it. As the web servers came back online, the stories in the press died down. I think as long as we have the internet with us, we will always have distributed denial of service attacks. I think that if you were to ask me to predict the future, I would say that a few things are likely to be true. The first is that I think for the foreseeable future, America's experience of cybercrime, whatever type of cybercrime you're talking about, is going to be very similar to Korea's. And I think that's just a function of the basic architectural similarities as well as the cultural similarities. I think Korea may have certain greater vulnerabilities, as I've mentioned, because of its higher use, higher reliance on high technology, and because, frankly, the grid is smaller. You know, the U.S. grid, purely as a matter of physical space, is much larger, right? Korea is the size of Indiana, basically. So the grid is smaller. And so I think for traditional crimes, especially, the future will remain very, very similar. I think for intellectual property crimes, piracy of software and games, I think a lot will be determined by cultural norms and by how the businesses that produce the content change and evolve their business models. And that might be similar in Korea and the United States, or it might be different. And then I think a couple of other things are going to be true. The first is that I think for crimes that hurt people online, whether you're talking about harassment, defamation, the crimes that, you know, lead people to kill themselves or experience severe emotional trauma, I think the future is largely going to be governed by legislation, and what the various legislatures, both in the U.S. state houses, as well as the U.S. Congress, as well as the Korean parliament, decide to do. And it's a very gray area of law. And there are obviously First Amendment concerns that both countries share. But I think the future there will largely be determined by legislation. And then finally, I think that, you know, one thing that's going to happen in response to the fact that you have and will always have hacking crimes with us and denial of service attacks with us, I think increasingly you will see in both countries' legislatures a sense that, at least with respect to large corporations and large data owners, they have greater duties. Indeed, they have legal duties to protect and defend against these attacks. And so I think you will continue to see, as you've seen in the United States, laws which require companies to impose reasonable security measures guarding the identity, the information that they have concerning people's identity and other sensitive information. And I think that, for me as a lawyer, is going to be one very interesting area to watch because, of course, many of my clients are corporations and they're frankly beside themselves with what to do about safeguarding personal identifying information, sensitive trade secret information, confidential data. And they are, as much as government entities are, serious subjects of hacking activity, state-sponsored espionage, corporate espionage, and the like. So, you know, if you ask me to read the future, I think that's what the future would be. We don't, of course, know when the next denial of service attack will happen. It could be today. It could be tomorrow. We don't know if it'll be successful or won't be successful. I wouldn't be surprised if you saw increasing crimes targeting, again, Korea and the United States, again, simply by virtue of the fact that they're great target-rich environments.
Thank you. We talked about the zombie computers and the botnets. Maybe we should talk a little bit about how they're comprised. This isn't a criminal in England having a room full of 100 computers, right, that are all going to attack, right? These are your computer at home, my computer at home.
That's right? Correct. That's absolutely correct. It is someone who, because they've infected your computer with a virus, maybe they sent you a picture or a message or an email that you opened, have remote control over your computer. And they don't know you. It's nothing personal. To them, all you are is an IP address, just a number, that your computer is assigned by the ISPs. But they can control your computer remotely to serve as a launch pad for the attack when they so desire.
So normally when people say, oh, I got a virus, you know, your computer isn't acting right, your computer is crashing. But in these situations, the people who write the viruses don't want you to think that there's anything wrong, right? You want to be able to go on doing your banking, go on playing your games and not realizing.
Correct.
And in the background, unknown to you, your computer could be used for criminal activity.
Absolutely true. The bot herder has an interest in making sure that your computer seems to function normally and, of course, wants to target computers that are connected to high-speed connections.
So the person who has high-speed internet, cable or DSL at home, and even fiber these days, right, are probably more more valuable to the bot herder.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the safest computer, of course, is one that is turned off and never connected to the internet. But the more connectivity and the more power your computer has, the more useful it is to someone who wants to launch a denial of service attack.
We talked about, or you talked about, these different classes of attacks. One of them being someone storing maybe illegal information on your computer network without you knowing it. Another class was spyware, and maybe we should explain like what is spyware and why that's different than, say, a Trojan, or why that's different than, say, a phishing attack.
Sure, absolutely. By spyware, essentially what I mean is our computer programs, which are downloaded onto your computer, typically, again, without you knowing it, that will record all of the keystroking, all of the actual keys that you hit on your computer's keyboard, and then periodically transmit that data out to the person who's installed the spyware on your computer. So, for example, you would go onto your bank's website in order to conduct online banking. You would first enter the bank's web address, and then you would navigate over to the login screen. You would type in your username, you would type in your password, and the spyware would be collecting all of that information and emailing it to the bad guy. You would then engage in certain banking transactions and then log off. Well, after you've logged off, the bad guy just takes a look at that and reads it through as a narrative, reads what the spyware has collected through as a narrative. And it's almost like the fruits of a wiretap or a data tap. They then can use that from their computer to log on to the same bank's website and perhaps transfer money out of your account into their account.
And we talked about Trojans. So these are like a Trojan horse, something that you think is doing one thing.
Correct.
But in the background
Correct.
Could be...
Correct. So if you remember your Greek mythology, the Trojan horse was ostensibly a gift, which was this large carved wooden horse, but contained an army, a malicious army. And so, the name was applied to computer programs, which seem to be innocuous. For example, someone sends you, a picture of a puppy, or someone sends you a joke, or someone sends you a link to a funny website with a goofy video. Or as in the case, several years ago, a note that says, I love you. You know, who doesn't like to get such notes? And you click on that. And by clicking on that, it's not apparent to you, but you've essentially allowed the bad guys to download a virus onto your computer, which then can do any one of a number of bad things.
And the other buzzword we use was a phishing attack.
Sure. So a phishing scheme, usually launched in collaboration with a spam email marketing campaign, would involve you getting an unsolicited email ostensibly from your bank or your credit card company or a merchant that you did business with, inviting you to click on a link because they need to update your account information. You click on the link, and you're brought to what seems to be a web page that's run by the legitimate merchant, but really has just been cut and pasted and is under the control of a bad guy. Again, you enter in your sensitive personal and financial information, and now the bad guy has that in order to either charge items to your credit card, loot your bank accounts, or engage in a series of other misdeeds.
And because email is so cheap to send out, right? Even if 1,000 people look at the email and say this isn't right, it's easy to find one person who might.
Very easy. And typically, these spam emails are sent out in batches of millions, and so even if you get 0.1% of a positive response rate, if you send out 50 million, 100 million, 200 million pieces of spam, that's still going to get you a decent number of people who've bit.
Mm-hmm. With the war on terror, mm-hmm. And in the physical battle space, we've been hearing a lot about non-state actors and unconventional warfare. It seems that in this field, there really are many, many opportunities for non-state actors to even advance state interests. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, how one of these attacks could possibly be set up if you were a state and you wanted to further your foreign policy.
Absolutely. Well, look, whether you're a state or a non-state actor,
right.
If you have a beef against a country, whether that country is the United States or South Korea, and look, there are people in countries that have beefs against the United States and South Korea, and you want to wreak havoc, you can do a number of things. You can launch denial of service attacks against their major commercial portals, their major internet portals, as well as their government and military sites. You know, we saw this actually in the run-up to the war in the Republic of Georgia, where there were a series of concerted cyber attacks directed against the country's telecommunications infrastructure. And what happened in that case was that the hackers went after the telecommunications system, and they were very successful in taking out the nation's telecommunications and cell phone network. What they didn't realize was just how successful they were, because in Georgia, the banking system rode on the cell phone network. So when they took out the cell phone network, they took out the banking system. And so checks weren't clearing overnight. Wire transfers couldn't be processed. And so simply by directing an attack against the country's cell phone system, they actually took the country out of the global economic system, because for a very, very short period of time, were countries willing to do business with Georgia when the very basic fundamentals of its banking system's integrity were in question. After that attack went on for, I believe, more than 6 hours or 12 hours, other countries simply stopped processing payments to and from Georgia. And so if you can take out a country from the global international monetary system, you can very quickly bring a country to its knees.
So this is kind of like some of the terrorist groups, right? Where
and terrorists can do that too.
Right. Where you have a terrorist group that's really not part of any country, right? That's maybe in a host country or maybe in a number of host countries, maybe furthering the aims of an actual state actor. Maybe not. There's that deniability there. So if you were a state, you could hire someone in another state to use computers in yet another state to further your aims.
Absolutely.
Are those the sort of things we've been seeing?
It's hard to say because,
yeah,
of course, countries are not being transparent about that, nor are the criminals they hire. I suspect that certainly is possible. You know, the countries, of course, have themselves very well-developed institutional information warfare capabilities, where there are probably, you know, greater senses of loyalty and comfort in dealing with your own in-house people rather than hiring an outsider. But that said, I would certainly not discount the possibility of non-state actors being hired by states to engage in these types of activities.
But your information is that states that want to do this are trying to develop their own homegrown.
I mean, I think there's been a lot of,
right,
it's been reported publicly that, you know, most of the major countries have very good in-house information warfare capabilities. Indeed, it's a question I posed here at the Korea Society to the general who's in command of the demilitarized zone, and he answered it in an appropriately generic way. But I think you can bet your bottom dollar that, you know, the United States, Korea, and its major allies and adversaries have very well-developed, robust information warfare capabilities in their military systems. And I think, you know, the press has spoken about very good capabilities by the French, by the Israelis, and other nations.
When there is an attack, let's say in the United States or maybe you know about Korea, when is it a law enforcement problem? When is it a military problem?
It's a great question, and one that we struggled with as prosecutors quite often, because, of course, all you know initially from an attack is perhaps an IP address, the location of a computer where the attack came from. And you really can't tell. It's hard to get inside the head of the person who is at the keyboard launching that attack. So you have to work by inference. You know, some crimes are clearly purely financial in nature. And those, you know, are maybe a little bit more presumptively private rather than state sponsored. But it is a very difficult question and one that, you know, we struggled with a lot. And oftentimes, you know, we would open up a criminal case at the same time that, you know, the military would open up a criminal investigation, and we would work them concurrently and jointly, until it became clear who was behind it.
Mm-hmm. As far as copyright violations, you talked about two aspects, one of them being the culture of the society and also business models. So as far as the culture goes, certainly in the United States and maybe internationally, there is this, how should I say, idea that on the internet, people who are very against any sort of digital rights management, the idea that information wants to be free. And to a certain extent, you know, there has its good side there and also has its bad side. And I think Congress even commissioned some study. I mean, I think this was for the digital audio tapes, where people just didn't know that if they made a copy, that was a copyright violation. And you hear even people today say, if you copy a CD, and someone will say, well, but I'm not selling it. You know, it's for me. Is that a copyright violation? Is that against the law?
Yeah, well, it really depends. I mean, you know, if you're talking about one simple copy, you know, and you're not selling it, it probably isn't. But I think your question raises, you know, a larger subject. And I actually teach an internet crimes and IP crime seminar at Columbia, and it's been fascinating to me to do that because, you know, you have in law schools entire schools of thought devoted to the abolition of copyright. And they publish papers, and they're very well respected. And certainly, if you're talking about the generation, say, under the age of about 35, and certainly if you're talking about the generation that's in their teens and 20s, there are real fundamental questions among members of that generation as to whether or not there should be copyright. Because, as you said, you know, there's a prevailing view that the information just wants to be free and it should get out there. And, you know, artists and musicians should make money not through selling their records, but reputationally, you know, by giving away their music. And then maybe they become famous and then they sell their guitar, and that's how they should monetize their creativity. And on the other side of the coin, you know, are large corporations like the movie studios, which invest hundreds of millions of dollars in a movie, and want people to go to the movies to recoup that gain. There is a huge cultural divide then, I think, between people who are in their 50s and between people that are in their 20s. I think I'm right on the cusp of that divide. And I think there are good arguments on both sides. And I think what you're seeing actually increasingly are the companies coming around to trying in a kind of yet still groping way, develop new business models designed to take account of the reality that the generation that exists under the age of 35 is never going to be the generation that's, you know, over 55 when it comes to thinking about these issues. And I think that's going to be fascinating to see how that evolves. And it's really taking a great deal of creative thinking on the part of people in corporations, as well as lawyers, as well as government regulators, as you said, who are responsible for this, this type of legislation. I think you may have actually seen, you know, recently, the French National Assembly passed a bill which allowed the ISPs, or may have even compelled ISPs, to disconnect people from internet service if those people were believed to have, you know, be using that service to download pirated movies and works. They got one warning, but after that warning, they were cut off. You know, very different approach than in the United States and Korea.
So the business model is, of course, very interesting. For example, right now, these massively multiplayer games are very, very popular. Mm-hmm. And, of course, people enjoy the gameplay. But behind there's a reason why these games now connect to a server and why there's a subscription model.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. You know, look, I can't speak for people that want the abolition of copyright, so I really can't, mm-hmm. you know, but clearly there are tensions and internal inconsistencies right, right, right. between mm-hmm. those, I think a lot of people who have developed those types of games have premised it on the existence of copyright, not the abolition of copyright.
Right, right. This may account for the marketplace as it is now, where we have more subscription models than just purchasing a game from a store and installing it on your computer.
Sure.
Where the companies sure. ensure a revenue stream because mm-hmm. you have to contact them regularly in order to keep on playing your copy of the game. So.
I think that's right.
The opinions expressed in the preceding program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Korea Society, its staff, management, or sponsors.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Korea Society. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Visit www.koreasociety.org for more information about memberships and to learn more about the programs available at the Korea Society.